So this is the last lecture for this season, but we'll be back in September. And usually in September we do the second Friday, so keep your ears open and eyes open. And if you want to be on our mailing list, please sign our mailing list if you aren't already, and make your mail it, your name clear and your email address clear, so we can see get you out an email. So it's usually the first Friday of every month, but there are a couple times it's the second Friday. So, and please, we really appreciate and need your donation. David, we're bringing David all the way from New Orleans, right? New Orleans.
That's close.
And we need money to bring people like David here and to pay our webmaster and the website and all that kind of stuff. So David is at least worth $10. We can do an auction. Okay, we don't take a break, but the bathroom, there's a bathroom right out here that says it's for men, but don't worry about that. This is Smith College, it doesn't matter. So, take a break if you need it. There is a handout for tonight to go along with the lecture, so if you didn't get one, raise your hand and Judy will give you one.
There aren't any more.
Oh, we ran out already. Wow. Okay. So, well, you can share. Share with your neighbor. Okay. We are still looking for a volunteer to help distribute flyers sometimes. So if anybody is interested in helping us get the word out, just come up to Carol. Sure.
Any adventurers out there who have the fantasy of mapping Western territory, you know, something like Lewis and Clark, we're going to map the territory and find out where the bulletin boards are and put flyers up so that people know what's happening. So if anyone's of that spirit and wants to have a good time, please talk to me.
We'd like to start videoing when we have video stuff. So if anybody knows how to do that, put it on YouTube, please come forward. Okay. And let's see. So I just want to mention that we have at the Boston Institute that does candidate training, if anybody's interested in training. There is also an auditor program that people can go and take classes, the first stage classwork, and there is a flyer here. If you're interested in any of the analysts in the room, Anita, Thayer, Karen, me, we'd be happy to talk to you about the Boston Institute and auditing. And also, this is fresh off the press. This is the summer intensive for the Boston Institute. They have a 4-day summer intensive at the end of June, and Anita and Thayer Green are going to be presenting. And this isn't even out on the email, so you guys get to see it first. But I didn't have time to make copies, so just take a look. Please don't take it. Just take a look at it and see what the name of the 4 days is, covers everything. Matter, Psyche, and Transformation. Science, Shamanism, Eastern Religions, and the Myth of Alchemy in the Unus Mundus Today. So, that sort of covers the universe and everything. So, take a look at that. Okay, the other thing is that we've been doing is a wonderful book group. We just finished Memories, Dreams, Reflections for the second time in our book group, which was very rich and wonderful. And we're thinking in the fall, maybe, how many people would like to read and talk about, and in the book group we don't just talk about the book, but we talk about how it affects our lives and what it means to us. Man and His Symbols by Jung. Would anybody be interested in that book? If you know what it is. So that might be a book that we might think about doing. All right. Okay, so, and after this, We go to the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street for a salon, and David is actually going to be there, which is a real treat, to talk and ask him questions and to talk amongst ourselves and share community. So please come join us. And for his workshop tomorrow, which is in 105 down the hall, would you please sign the workshop sheet so we have an idea of how many people are coming and we can know you're coming. Okay, so it'll be right down the hall. All right. So tonight we have David Shane to speak on the war of addiction. He has a few books here for $30. War of Addiction. Well, the War of the Gods in Addiction. And he has about 11 books for $30. If you have cash or a check and you want to purchase a book tonight, you can. And he'll even sign it for you and say something nice or not. So please feel free. And tomorrow the workshop is, he's focusing more on the fairy tale, myth, and religious aspect of this whole subject, which should be very interesting. So David is a very special person to me. He started out as a social worker. He became a Jungian analyst. We are litter mates. I thought that would be a little surprising. It's not that we've just hung out in the shit in all our litter boxes through our training and life, but we got into the training program with the Interregional Society at the same time, so we became litter mates. And we helped each other through the training, through many vicissitudes and hurdles and all the things you go through in training. And I'm so happy to have him here because David is like a brother to me. He's my brother. So he wrote this book, and it's been how many languages or how many countries has it been?
It's out there.
And it's becoming more and more talked about. So I'll let him take over and tell you all more about it. So if you don't have a handout, oh, just share with other people. Okay. Have a good evening, and we'll hopefully see you at the Mosaic Cafe.
Thank you, Erica. I appreciate that. I want to thank the Young Association of Western Mass, and I want to thank Smith College for giving this wonderful auditorium, and I want to thank Erica for arranging to have me come. As Erica said, I have worked as an addiction counselor. I'm an LCSW, clinical social worker, and a Jungian analyst. So that's who I am, but I always like to know a little bit, if I can get you all to commit yourselves, just raise your hand. How many people here are a therapist of some sort? Okay. How many are in the field of addiction, chemical dependency stuff? A few. Okay. How many folks are involved in 12-step programs? Okay. And how about the Jungians here? Jungian folks? Kind of evenly scattered. How many people are just interested in the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil is particularly interesting? Okay. Well, let me see. This picture is really interesting that you all put on the flyer, because a few years ago, every year we go to Mardi Gras, and the Friday before Mardi Gras, my wife always does a bustier costume, and she one year did Maleficent, and she thought that was appropriate, you know. Tonight, I'm going to be talking about the whole idea of the psychodynamics of addiction. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration did a survey, and they found that 23% of the population were abusing alcohol, but they were binge drinkers. That's three or more binge drinkings a month. heavy drinkers were 5 or more binges a month. That's about 7%. Basically, rounding out things, the number is 20% of the population has problems with alcohol or drugs, is the estimation. The population I'm going to be really talking about tonight is 7%. This is really the what back in the old days when AA started and all, these were really considered, you know, hardcore drinkers. These were people who were addicted. This wasn't people who had a problem with drinking or they could control it or not control it. This was really the worst stuff, okay? I describe myself as a phenomenologist in this sense. I don't really care about theories for their own sake. So I'm a Jungian analyst, but I'm not going to sit up here and defend Jungian psychology or theory or any other theory. To me, theories are maps that either are helpful in helping us understand and reflect the phenomena of what's going on or not. So I'm fine with lots of different theories shedding different aspects of light on things. And if they're helpful, they're helpful. And if they're not, they're not. I think there are, sadly, a lot of theories out there that what I call don't hold water. You know, they don't really reflect the phenomenon. Well, I'm in search of the phenomenon of addiction and what that's all about. So in that spirit, I'm more concerned about understanding the phenomena than defending any particular view on it. And I'm perfectly fine with you accepting as much as you want of what I say or rejecting as much as you want, etc. At the end, I'm gonna open it up for questions and comments. And but I want to first give you an overview of where I'm coming from. Basically, the story starts back the pre-1930s, and alcoholism, and I'm using alcoholism as the template for addiction because I think most of the work that's been done in regards to psychological addiction, which is what I'm going to be focusing on, came out of the alcoholism experience. And before the 1930s, pretty much, if you were an alcoholic, that 7%, it was a hopeless, degenerative illness that ultimately led to death. And they tried everything back then. They tried rescuers, they tried aversion therapy, they tried all kinds of psychotherapy, analysis, Freudian, Jungian, Adlerian. People took the pledge, went to church and, you know, swore to stop drinking and couldn't. And so basically it was a situation where nothing was really effective. There were a few things that came along that seemed to have some impact for a while, but nothing was really sticking and nothing seemed to be able to get a handle on the situation, to arrest the alcoholism, or to cure it for sure. Then, in the 1930s, Bill W. and Dr. Bob basically started Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll talk more about, you know, some of the antecedents of that. But what was interesting to me was that at that time, they started getting previously hopeless alcoholics sober and keeping a large percentage of them sober by the AA program and the 12 steps. And so my curiosity was, as a phenomena, was So if we had a previously incurable, hopeless disease, and then all of a sudden something came along and started arresting 30% of it, or 33% of it, of course, there are no official statistics in terms of AA because it's a volunteer program and involvement and it's anonymous, but the rough things were that it clearly was helping a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people get sober and stay sober, okay? So then that got me wondering about, well, okay, so if there was an incurable cancer and then there was something that came along that was arresting that, what was it about that cure? What did that tell us? That why was it working? Why was that helpful? And that led backwards to, we could say AA was effective in not curing, but in arresting alcoholism. And so then, what were the ingredients in AA that were the effective ingredients in allowing that to happen? And then by looking at that sort of in a reductive, detective way, we go backwards to finding out what, by what's effective in arresting it and helping here, we find out more information about the nature of addiction from that. It's kind of working your way backwards. You find something that works, and then you then start looking back. Okay, so what is that affecting in that particular area? So why was it effective? And of course, this leads back to the basic, what I consider the basic nature of addiction, alcoholism, and addiction. As we go along, this map is really well drawn. I'm not a PowerPoint person, sorry. But this basically is a map that, because I'm a visual person, can illustrate. This is a Jungian view of the psyche, and this is the persona in Jungian psychology, the mask that we wear in relation to the world. This is the personal shadow. Down here is archetypal shadow, and these things combine. And anyway, so this gives you a visual of what's going on. This page gives you a very brief outline of what I'm going to be presenting tonight. I'll talk about the definition of a psychological addiction, and then I'll talk about the development of the stages of a typical addiction, and then the healing process that occurs with the 12 steps of AA.
We ran out of these handouts, so if you could sort of...
So, in my definition of addiction, which I didn't just arrive at because that's what I like to do, I arrived at it based on what I had observed in terms of this phenomenon. First of all, that the addictive behavior must take over complete and total control of the individual psychologically. Their ego functioning, thoughts, emotions, decisions, behaviors, etc. It becomes the prime directive in the psyche. The second crucial part of this definition is that the addictive behavior must have the capacity and potential to kill and destroy the whole person. Now, the reason that I say that is because, in my opinion, it's not helpful when we define everything out there as an addiction. It just becomes confusing. There are some things that will kill you, and there are other things that maybe will make you fat, okay? Chocolate, as far as I am concerned, is not an addiction. You know, people who talk about positive addictions, that confuses things. Addiction originally comes from the Latin root of addictus, which meant devoted to. So in the old literature, you could read about people who were addicted to God. they were devoted to God. But in our modern times, addiction has the whole connotation of something negative and destructive. And you know, I mean, we'd be okay if we had another term, but that's what we have. But I think it's really important that we distinguish between what is an addiction and what's abuse and what's bad habits and what's not good for us and things like that, that it's not the same or identical with an addiction. And the reason that's important is because what's effective in dealing with the with these other things of abuse or bad habits or things that are not good for us is different than what will work in terms of an addiction. Now, I really am basing pretty much the whole book on the template of the Carl Jung, Bill W. letters. And basically, Bill W., one of the co-founders of AA, wrote Carl Jung in 1961, January. Jung wrote back, he wrote back on January 30th, so that's hardly a week, okay? This is during the, you know, holiday season, Christmas and stuff. A letter would have had to travel across the ocean, and Jung would have had to get it and written back immediately, okay? Pretty immediately to come back to Bill W. What is interesting about the exchange of the letters is that there's so much information in there about, well, AA and where it comes from, and also Jung's view on addiction, which he really, and alcoholism, and he really didn't go on record before very much. He was doing a lot of other things, but he didn't really say much. But in the letter back to Bill W., he really goes on record saying some pretty shocking and important things. So Bill W.'s letter to Carl Jung, he basically is saying to Jung that he had traced back to, Jung had worked with a man named Roland H., had done analysis with him for about a year, he had gotten sober and was doing okay, and then, as typical, he relapsed. And Roland went back to Jung, I'm summarizing here, you can read the letters yourselves, went back to Jung, and he thought he would get a, you know, whatever, an extra kick up on it, you know, a follow up that would do it. And Jung basically told Roland that there was nothing more that he could do. I guess Roland was thinking that some more analysis, and I'm sure that Jung worked with him on all the stuff that analysis works on, the shadow and complexes and anima and animus and self and all that. But Jung basically, this is probably the best psychoanalyst in the whole world at the time, says, I can't help you. There's nothing more I can do. Now, there are not that many therapists and analysts who I know who have the humility to say that, you know? And so, based on that, Roland, well, let me read what Bill W. said. My recollection of Roland's account of the conversation is that you frankly told him of his hopelessness so far as any further medical or psychiatric treatment might be concerned. The candid and humble statement of yours was beyond doubt the first foundation stone upon which our society has been built. Jung did not know at the time when he did that that he was actually intuiting the first step of AA, of the 12 steps, that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Jung admitted to Roland that that he was powerless over the situation, the alcohol in Roland's life, and that Roland was. So he, in effect, took the first step without knowing it. And then when Roland asked you if there was any other hope, this is Bill W. talking, you told him that there might be, provided he could become the subject of a spiritual or religious experience, in short, a genuine conversion. And again, Jung intuited step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So Jung offers hope to Roland that there is a possibility, but a possibility based in not what Jung called a higher power, but in a religious or spiritual experience. So Jung, again, not knowing, took step two with Roland. And then you recommended that he place himself in a religious atmosphere and hope for the best. This, I believe, was the substance of your advice. And that basically was to take step three. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, or the higher power. So the foundation steps of AA, the 12 steps, are actually, Jung is responsible for them. Now, it was Bill W. who had the brilliance to be able to translate that afterwards. But what happened in the story was that Roland went on to get, he got involved with the Oxford movement at the time. The Oxford movement was a movement in the U.S. and in Europe that was getting people sober, and they were using a lot of the same principles of that AA has in steps 4 through 10. That is, that they were encouraging people to do a moral inventory and to make amends and to do a confession and to live their lives in that whole spirit of those things. And it was getting people sober. The problem with the Oxford movement was that they basically, if you started drinking again, they kicked you out, okay? So if you're an alcoholic, you know how difficult it is to get and stay sober. And so this particular thing that the Oxford movement was doing wasn't really helpful. Again, AA's brilliance in this area was that they incorporated the principles that were effective in the Oxford movement, but they didn't make not drinking a condition to be a part of AA. In fact, the only requirement to go to AA is that you have a desire to stop drinking. Not that you're sober. You can go drunk as a skunk, and people, you know, you may get some kind of looks and things, but all you needed, it was the desire to want to stop drinking. It was the only requirement. And so that was brilliant in the sense of it didn't shame and judge the alcoholic who relapsed into not coming back and benefiting from the program. So Roland went to, in his work, brought this to Evie T., who was another hopeless alcoholic at the time, had been in, you know, dry out facilities and treatment programs and that were at that time usually medical, that really weren't effective, and everybody had pretty much given up on Evie T. But Evie T. saw that Roland, who was also had been like him, was really looking good and sober, and you know. So then Evie T. actually was a friend of Bill W.'s, and Bill W. was another one of those hopeless folks at the time who had been basically told that he was in a death sentence. And Evie T. then helped Bill W. get sober, told the story of the history of what had happened. And then Bill W. became one of the people who carried on and was able to formulate the concepts here that wound up with AA and 12 steps. So, and then at the time, Bill W. said to Jung that at the time at the last quarter century, there was about 300,000 people were in recovery through AA and through the world, and there were over 8,000 AA groups. Probably now there are probably millions of, you know, around the world and every place you can go. So it's really grown a lot since the beginning. So then we go over to Jung's response to Bill W. And basically, he wrote back, and in my view of what he did was Jung, he wanted to say something about addiction and the psychodynamics of addiction, but he knew he was already in trouble with a lot of people for things he was saying, you know, that they didn't like, and he knew that this would really be a shocker. So my view is he kind of, as he was leaving, you know, this world, about, you know, 5 months before he died, he sort of rolled out the hand grenade and moved on, okay? Now, it's taken a long time for this hand grenade to explode, but it is explosive in terms of what he was suggesting, and that is a lot of the essence of the book that I've written, which is that he was pointing to the existence in the psychodynamics of addiction of archetypal shadow, archetypal evil. And that wasn't clearly anywhere. But let me go to his letter to Bill W. He said, Roland's craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. So Jung saw alcoholism as a thirst for a spiritual thing that was being misplaced and put into the alcohol. But it was a thirst, a desire, ultimately, for a union with God. And then he says, you might be led to that goal, to sobriety, by an act of grace, or through a personal and honest contact with friends, or through a higher education of the mind, beyond the mere confines of rationalism. Jung, in this letter, again, he intuits that by an act of grace, could be the higher power, could be turning things over. The personal and honest contact with friends is about the fellowship with AA, and the higher education of the mind is about the 12 steps and working those steps, and it's not about concrete rationalism. And so Jung is basically pointing out in his letter to Bill W. the three main principles of AA. And then Jung says, and this is what really, to me, is sort of amazing. He said, I'm strongly convinced that the evil principle prevailing in this world leads the unrecognized spiritual need into perdition if it is not counteracted by real religious insight or by the protective wall of human community. Now, I think Jung knew what he was saying. He didn't say it might, there's a problem. He is saying in this world will lead the unrecognized person into that. In other words, that there's something so powerful that if a person is in any way really naive and not assessing things in any realistic way, that he's really going to be in trouble. And by this real religious insight or the protective wall of human community. Now, to me, the protective wall of human community is sort of like the herd and the, you know, the predators, if you're, you know, cattle or sheep or something, are always looking for a straggler, you know, that moves away from the protective pack where they can pick them off, you know. And one of the things with alcoholism is that it inherently pushes a person to isolation, which makes them more of a prey to the addiction than if they can stay with people in the human community who care about them and love them, even if they're drinking, you know. But then Jung says, an ordinary man not protected by an action from above, higher power, isolated in community, no fellowship, cannot resist the power of evil. Cannot resist the power of evil. He didn't say he would have trouble with it, might, you know, might be difficult. He said can't do it. That it's so powerful that unless you have these things involved, it will get you. It will take you out. And then he goes on to say it's very aptly called the devil. Well, of course, we all know the devil doesn't exist, right? We're all beyond that. That's unrealistic. That's all archaic stuff. No, what Jung was saying was not that he believed in the devil with the pitchfork and horns, or even a, you know, different forms of the mythologies of the devil. But what he was saying is that the devil, in different traditions, best represented the psychological phenomenon that he saw in alcoholism and addiction. That there was an aspect of it that was inherently evil, and that it had a powerful component that he would call the devil, which is transpersonal, which is archetypal. And so he's positing here, he didn't call it, by my words, archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, but he's alluding to that very concept in this. And then he ends his letter to Bill W. by saying, you see, alcohol in Latin is spiritus, and you use the same word for the highest religious experience as well as for the most depraving poison. So the helpful formula is therefore spiritus contra spiritum. The spirit against the spirit. The way I say it, my, you know, common sort of thing, it's the big guns against the big guns, you know. You can't take out something archetypal and neutralize it with the ego. You have to have something of an equal power and force, okay? So if there's archetypal shadow and archetypal evil in addiction, to neutralize that, you have to have archetypal good and positive spiritual power that is at least equal to that to neutralize it. Now, one of the reasons that I think the definition of alcoholism and what is it, isn't, is so important is because of this. If you are involved in addictive behavior, and I don't draw a circle around what could qualify as an addiction. I say if it takes over the whole psyche and it has the potential to kill you, will you supply what that is? And that could be a whole bunch of different things, you know. That could be food, sex, could be drugs, alcohol, could be work, could be could be a lot of things. So if it fits the definition, then I think it is an addiction, okay? Now, on the other hand, if someone is messing around in the area of potentially addictive behavior, but they have not crossed over the line, and the addiction has not gotten its teeth into them, then what is effective is a lot of our ego-oriented strengthening, education, self-control, self-discipline stuff, which I'm fine with if someone comes to me and says, I think I'm drinking too much and I don't want to become an alcoholic. And I say, okay, well, let's strengthen those psychological muscles that are going to keep you from drinking too much. And, you know, and then you use self-discipline and ego control and you moderate it and you know, you get a handle on it. If the person can do that, I don't care how much they're drinking, if they can do that, then they're not addicted in my book, okay? If they try to do that, and most alcoholics have tried over and over and over again to stop drinking and promised and broken people's hearts and everything, and haven't been able to do it because the addiction was inherently more powerful than their egos and their ego control. So as long as they kept approaching the alcoholism or the addiction through attempts at ego control, it wasn't going to work. That's one of the reasons why you say, well, you know, when people take the pledge at church or, you know, whatever, you know, that's religious. Why didn't that work? Well, because they were basically not saying, you know, it's the higher power that's taking over. You have to humble and surrender the ego for this to happen. The whole pledge was, you know, you're going to stop drinking and, you know, we're going to be there and, you know, we're going to cheer you on. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So, Jung is basically presenting that idea in terms of the that it would take the higher power archetypal positive energy to neutralize the archetypal shadow archetypal evil. Now, lose my way on this. Let me say just briefly that archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, the idea of unintegratable aspects of the psyche is not my invention. If we think about it, there are a number of other places where we can find this already in the literature in terms of psychodynamics. Freud posited at some point, it didn't gain a lot of traction, but he did posit a Thanatos Eros theory. And what he was saying was, he was really right on this, but it wasn't very popular, so I think he abandoned it for things that people would be more interested in, like sex, you know? But the Thanatos and the Eros was that he believed that there was inherently a death instinct in people. Everybody. So we're talking archetypal, it's universal. And there was a life instinct, eros, in people. He was using the term eros to meaning a life instinct, okay? And they were battling it out. What's interesting about this is that I'm on a suicide prevention board in my state and my county, whatever. And one of the things that they talked about is that in the situation with suicide, in many, many cases, what's going on is that there's this part of people that wants to die. Life's getting to be too much, whatever's going on. And most of the time, the part that wants to live, their reasons to live, to stay in this world, is bigger than the part that is thinking about, you know what, I want to check out of here. This is getting pretty bad. But sometimes things happen that this shrinks in terms of the part that wants to live, and then the part that wants to die begins to expand. And of course, that's the most dangerous time for people. And so you want to buy time. You want to make sure that they don't have lethal means to do things. You want them to go see somebody. You know to try to help them to get back and increase this part of wanting to live. Now, one of the things that the research found was that in terms of suicide, that probably 95% of the population that means all of us basically, okay, has thought about or contemplated the idea of suicide at some point in their life. So it's not saying that everybody has taken an action, but sometimes we get to really difficult places when we things do feel hopeless and we want to give up. And you hear people say, well, you know, this is so much pain at this point, I'm so depressed, I would rather be dead, you know. And sometimes the pain is so great that that is the thought, and sometimes people do follow through on it. But my point here is that if 95% plus of the population has thought about suicide, then it isn't abnormal. This idea of wanting to die at some point is also inherently part of human nature. So Freud wasn't that far off. Don Kalshed wrote a book, what's the name of that book? The Inner World of Trauma, Archetypal Defenses of the Personal Spirit. And in that book, he theorizes a protector-persecutor aspect of the psyche, which is the psyche's self-portrait of its own archaic defense operations. He describes this protector-persecutor as not being educable, which is another way of saying it cannot be modified, integrated, or transformed by the psyche. He describes the dynamics of the protector-persecutor in this way. As much as he or she, the trauma victim, wants to change, as hard as he or she tries to improve life or relationships, something more powerful than the ego continually undermines progress and destroys hope. It is as though the persecutory inner world somehow finds the outer mirror in repeated self-defeating reenactments. Almost as if the individual were possessed by some diabolical power or pursued by a malignant fate. You could take that same sentence and apply it to people who are truly addicted. But the idea here is that he was positing something that was another unintegratable aspect of the psyche. In alchemy, there's the lessiconiono, which is material in the alchemical process that has to be thrown out. If you keep it in, it's going to destroy the whole process, the alchemical process. And so that's another image of the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil. The idea is of archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, that it is not integratable, educatable, transformable, redeemable, etc. A lot of people, not a lot, some people have had real trouble because they have had a view of Jungian psychology that we befriend everything in the psyche and everything is integratable and everything, you know, can be redeemed and transformed. And there's a lot of stuff that can, and it's, you know, personal shadow for sure, but this archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, is something that can't be, and that we need to be able to take that very, very seriously when we approach that. And I think, other people have asked me, do you think there's archetypal shadow, archetypal evil in other places? You know, serial torturers or mass murderers, or, you know, and I don't know. I mean, it's very, very possible. How about sociopaths, psychopaths? Maybe so. I don't really know. I didn't study those things, but I did study this, and I do believe that in a true addiction, it is there. And it is not personal. Archetypal shadow, archetypal evil is not created by the individual. It is there. It's like the devil. It pre-exists. And if it comes into play, then it locks up with the other things to make an addiction. Okay, very, very briefly for tonight, and then I kind of want to open it up for thoughts and questions and all. I talk about the development of a typical addiction in the different stages. The first thing that usually happens for all of us is that the ego persona aligns with the false self. In other words, that we want to believe that we are something that we're really not. And so usually what gets left out? Well, of course, the personal shadow. All the things about us that we don't want to see and don't want to exist. And so we identify with our idealized version of ourselves. That's usually our persona. And then what happens when we have the personal shadow is that we're looking for ways to alleviate the tension in the psyche that comes up when the personal shadow is there. You know, we sanitize our garbage can and we suppress it and we do all kinds of things to try to avoid it. We might go to church more often, who knows? But one of the things that happens is that a lot of people turn to potentially addictive behavior. They start drinking to alleviate the tension and the stress. They go to gambling. They get over-involved in sex. They do drugs. These things, on a temporary basis, can relieve the tension and the stress that's involved in the psyche from this suppression of the personal shadow. But the more and more that a person does that, the worse it's going to get. Now, of course, if the person at this point goes to see a therapist or does something that's really helpful in terms of goes into analysis, begins to confront this part of themselves, they can integrate it and become more whole. But you have to take in that personal shadow. Now, I'm making a distinction between the personal shadow, which we create, and the archetypal shadow, which we don't create. But then, with this potentially addictive behavior, there is the creation of the addiction, what I call the addiction shadow complex. If you look on your map there, and you can show it to your neighbor, that would be good. So what basically happens is that the ego you got the persona and the false self, and that combines. The personal shadow is partly created by that, and then that combines with the addictive behavior, a potentially addictive behavior. It's still not an addiction. What, in my opinion, locks in the potentially addictive behavior as an addiction is when the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil aspect locks in to these other aspects. Before that, I think there's still things that can be done by a person with their ego and education and psychotherapy, etc. Now, many people have asked me, well, what locks in the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil? I don't really have an answer. Why does it happen to some people, not to other people? Why does a person drink all their life and not cross over the line, and then they lose their job, and then all of a sudden they collapse into addiction that they can't get out of? It seems that Native Americans may have some automatic predisposition, genetically or hereditarily, to becoming addicted. But psychologically, and that's what I'm talking about, not the medical, the genetic or the other aspects of addiction, they are really important. But what gets shorted on is the psychological aspect of addiction. It seems like some of them, the first time they start drinking, they're across the line and out of control. You know? So sometimes it happens fast, sometimes it happens slow, sometimes there are different factors that are involved. But when it locks in, then you have a true addiction. Okay. Then the process which AA discovered in terms of countering that, or the healing process in recovery, works just in reverse to the establishment of the addiction. It's the connection with the true self, the neutralizing of the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil aspect. So you start with the last thing that happened in the addiction is the first thing that happens in the recovery. You can't get to the other steps without taking the first three steps. You have to neutralize the archetypal evil, or you can't really effectively get to the other steps, because the addiction shadow complex is still going to be in charge of the ego hijacking it, and it's going to get the person to return to their addictive behavior. That's what it's designed to do. And it does, and why it wants to completely destroy the individual, I don't know, but that seems to be what the deal is. You know, when I present this to recovering folks, and I've presented all over the country, and I've really been watching to see whether what I'm saying holds water for them, and all I get is pretty much amen. Yeah, you know, we know what you're talking about. You don't have to convince us of what a monster an addiction is. I had a client who was in a treatment program. I was seeing him after he was out of the treatment program, and he was talking about he and his buddies were, in the first week or end of the first week in treatment, nothing really. And they were all patting themselves on the back saying, how far along they think they are, they can handle it now, and blah, 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 you know. And this old grizzled addiction counselor, a black guy, says, "Listen, boys, you need to understand, all that's really nice, but your addiction is out in the parking lot doing push-ups waiting for you." And you know what? That really made an impression. It was like, oh, wow, okay. You know, that they were so much underestimating the power and the danger of that. You know, I thought that was a great story. So the ego disidentifies with the persona of false self. In other words, that the ego stops identifying with that. There's a recognition that the ego is under the addiction shadow complex. What's that? That's basically, you look over here on the 12 steps, that's steps 1, 2, 3. That's admitted we were powerless, which is a collapse of the ego. This can't work if the addicted ego stays in control. It has to collapse and surrender. And this is fundamental. It's also fundamental to, you know, William James says in the Varieties of Religious Experience, it's fundamental to all genuine religious conversion experiences of any kind. That a person has to humble and surrender the ego to what? To the Buddha within, or the higher power, or God, or whatever, the will of God, or whatever you want. You can call it whatever you want, but that has to happen, or this isn't going to happen. In Jungian psychology, we would say that the person has to quit seeing the ego as the center of the psyche, calling all the shots, and needs to turn to the self, the big S self in the psyche, to look for what his or her individuation journey is all about, even if the person isn't addicted, that's what's necessary for that to happen. To give up the idea that we can control it all. You know, you can't. So that's the relativizing of the ego as the center of the psyche, and it is putting the self, the higher power, the Buddha, that whatever you want to call it. Again, the phenomena is what's important, and you can use all kinds of different labels for it if you're talking about that. You're talking about that phenomena and somehow that's absolutely necessary in your life. Then what's interesting is that the confronting and integrating of the personal shadow, in Jungian terms, which is what a lot of analysis is working on, you know, a lot of the time, but that's basically steps 4 through 10 in AA. made searching and fearless inventory, admitted to God ourselves and another human being, nature of our wrongs, were ready to have them removed, humbly asked to remove our shortcomings, made a list of all the people we had harmed, and became willing to make amends to them, made direct amends, went to such people whenever it was possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. You don't go make amends at the expense of the other person, you know? If it means you suffer with it, then that's what you do. But you need to be willing to do that. And continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, probably admitted it. All of that is basically stuff that we work on in analysis when we're working on shadow stuff. People taking psychological responsibility for themselves. In AA, it's crucial because if you don't do this, you're probably going to be set up to relapse, and then the addiction's going to have its teeth back in you again. And I know a number of people who were sober for a long time, relapsed, and thought they could just get back again, you know, sober and into the program, but they never could. They never could. And it killed them, you know, is basically what happened. Then the last two, 5 and 6, the ongoing maintenance of the ego self access, that's in Jungian terms, and then the person living in service with the self from that time. In 12 steps that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps, we try to carry the message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Now, I want to say something here because I really feel this pretty strongly. The masculine language in the 12 steps, I think, is a stumbling block for some people, especially women. And people say, oh, well, you know, they need to be able to translate what that's about and, you know, to get the essence of this. And I'm thinking, just change the language so that it's not offending and making a problem for people to come in. You know, why? I mean, I say this with the Catholic Church all the time. You know, change the stupid prayers and quit saying him and, you know, and he and talk about us or we or whatever you want. Thou, I don't care. You know, that's fine. But I think it's a problem, and there actually are some people who, because of the language, have a real problem buying it and accepting it and getting involved and really seeing the essence of what really is there. The other thing that can be a problem is that the theological use of God so many times makes it seem like you have to believe in a God to be in AA, and you don't. And if you read enough and you know, with the 12 steps in the big book and everything, you realize that you can have your own version of what the higher power is. And it could be the group, it could be the 12 steps, it could be the Great Spirit, it could be whatever you want. But what's most important there is that you're surrendering the ego to something that is more powerful than you, that you even are willing to consider that and to buy that. But for some people who are agnostic or atheist or something, the language in the 12 steps there in terms of God does become a problem. AA has not asked me to rewrite their steps, so I have not been invited, and I realize that I may be a voice crying in the wilderness. But I do think it's a great program. Sometimes people ask me, you know, are you saying, David, that the only way is AA? And I say, no, I'm not saying that the only way is AA. I'm saying that the only way with a true addiction, psychological addiction, is using the principles and ingredients of AA, or otherwise it won't be effective. And people, you know, people say, oh, well, this program is just as effective and blah, blah, blah. first of all, they don't make a distinction between abuse and addiction. They talk about problem drinkers, and they lump everybody in that category. That all needs to be separated out. Most of the recovery treatment programs that I know of have borrowed lock, stock, and barrel from the AA principles. Now, they retool it and use different words and everything, but they're talking about the same principles. And they may be effective. If, you know, for $30,000, you can get sober with those programs. Or you can go to 90 meetings in 90 days for free with AA, and maybe it'd be just as effective. You know, but my point is that the principles of AA, especially in terms of the psychodynamics, neutralize the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, and allow the person to begin to get into recovery through the other steps. I describe the first three steps of AA as the archetypal intervention aspect of the 12 steps, and then the other steps as the sort of normal ego stuff. But you can't get to the normal ego stuff unless you take those first steps. I threw a lot at you real fast. In alchemy, there's also a term, terra damnata, which is a cursed earth, which is the same concept that there are ingredients in the alchemical process, which is all about the transformation of the psyche, that have to be thrown out. It's a cursed earth. Otherwise, it will ruin the process. Okay, I'd like to open it up and hear comments or questions or whatever. Yes, back there.
My understanding, according to Jung, is that archetypal evil is part of the God
image. Is part of what?
The God image.
I don't think that's correct. I know in answer to Job, he talked about the dark side of God, but Jung, I can actually, if you give me a second. I have a quote from Jung on that, on archetypal shadow, archetypal evil. Jung himself addresses the questions of integrating personal shadow versus integrating archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, when he says, "It is quite within the bounds of possibility for a man to recognize the relative evil of his nature, but it is a rare and shattering experience for him to gaze into the face of absolute evil." The dark side of God that Jung writes about, and I'm not really sure I'll buy that because I'm a phenomenologist, okay? And it's okay to have a difference of opinion, but that is not the same as, of archetypal evil, absolute evil, which I think is what Jung is saying here, okay? So that would be my answer to your question. Yes?
So the atheist is doomed in this alchemical, psychological, if I have no faith, and I come to you for help?
Well,
there's
a couple of things there that I think are helpful. That I don't think you have to believe in a theist position. One of the things that Jungian psychology offers is that, you know, that the self, the big S self in the psyche, can be viewed as just part of the psyche. Or some people view it as the self is a reflection of an image outside of the psyche. God, or, you know, whatever, a theistic kind of position. You can believe it either way. Jung's not really going to argue that. He's saying the self is there, and it is higher. It is the highest power in the psyche, and we need to relate to it in terms of individuation and transformation. Now, in AA, as I was trying to say earlier, that the higher power the AA talks about, there are places in the literature where it talks about the fact that, in fact, there are sections in the Big Book about atheists and agnostics and their ability to still participate and benefit from the program without necessarily believing the same thing that maybe a lot of other folks believe. So the higher power can be, it could be the group, it could be the fellowship, it could be the 12 steps themselves, it could be your sponsor if you wanted, or I mean, not that I would make my sponsor into the higher power, but I'm not in recovery myself, I shouldn't have said it that way. But there are, in other words, the idea is that I mean, just being able to consider the reality that there are some phenomena beyond me and my ego which can influence me destructively or in a constructive, helpful way is the assertion of a higher power in a sense. Some people have even said to me, you know, the archetypal shadow, archetypal evil, and the addiction, in a sense, is a higher power. I said, yeah, you're right, you know, in the sense of it's a bad higher power, but that's what has to be neutralized.
You say it pre-exists time.
What?
It pre-exists. You said you mentioned it pre-exists. It's there.
Well, it's universal. All archetypal material is potentially there, universally. When we come to different stages in our life and things happen, the archetype gets activated. It's that, you know, Jung talks about it being like a dry riverbed, and then when the waters come, you know, it's full, and there's something going on. Or it's like a crystalline structure which has all the ingredients there, not all, but most of them, but they're inert, and then when the right ingredients connect, then all of a sudden you have it, you see, and you have to deal with it. It's like the archetype of the mother in most cases is activated when a woman becomes pregnant, and then there are all kinds of things psychologically and physiologically and all that within that are automatically activated. So in that sense, you know, or take for example when boys are becoming men or wanting to become men, the adolescents, the hero archetype is activated, and then they have to go out and prove themselves and do something. That's, the boy doesn't decide that. That the archetype overcomes him, and it takes him along in that way. So, okay, other, yes.
I've been in 12-step program, AA specifically for about 23 years, and I was always told, because I've had friends that were agnostic or atheists, tells you, as you said, you can use the group, you can use the doorknob, as long as it's not you.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, believe in something, but that's a higher power, as long as it's not you.
Right, and to me, that's the crucial part psychodynamically. You know, AA never really explained why their steps work and why the program works, but that's not their job. They don't have to convince. In fact, you know, the mental health communities really, for many years, was pretty hostile towards AA. You know, it's a cult and it's a brainwashing thing, and it, you know,
it's not
scientific. Yeah, right. And so, you know, part of what I wanted to do in writing this book is to say, no, there is a legitimate basis, a psychodynamic basis psychologically for this, and here it is. So, you people who can't buy the AA terminology, maybe you can buy my psychodynamic, psychological terminology and see why I'm saying it's effective. But yes, I agree.
I also wanted to say that when you said that about the push-up, you used to say to me, your knees have been doing push-ups for 3 hours before your alarm went off this morning.
Yes.
After listening to you, which is very interesting, I would like to posit that our imperial, industrial, patriarchal, corporate society are evil, and they're wrong for humans, and that suicide and addiction is our coping mechanism. I've done a lot of reading about Native society pre-Columbus. Columbus encountered Natives who were happy living where they were, food was available. They were cooperating with each other. They had a joyful way of being. And many people who write about Columbus, along with Columbus, say within 2 years, the people were miserable. They were in slavery. They were dying. They were unhappy. They were resentful. So I think it's, and Artie Lang would probably go along with this, that it's people reacting to this society who are committing suicide are our most sensitive people. And that when I have thought of suicide, it's when we have to fight by ourselves. We're individuals. We have to figure out our health care, our job, how we're going to exist, what clothes are we going to wear, what kind of job. And instead of being a cooperative communal society, we're on our own. And that's what makes us think of suicide and addiction. And it's really psychotherapy and all the therapies that try to help people cope with this society, which are a justification of the society that we're in. We're not seeing that it's the society that's oppressing us. And so much of my reading about pre-Columbus, what the people who are along with him say, what happened to people afterwards, happened to us. What happened to the Indians happened to us. They got rid of slavery and they invented the minimum wage. Okay, so but what was done to the Indians is done all over the world and is done to us who support the militaristic corporate society so we can have our benefits while what's happening in other countries happened to the Indians.
Okay, you may not feel very strongly about this.
I wanted to say it loud once.
I want to say that I there's a lot of things that you said that I agree with that are involved in that. My problem with Artie Lang and other folks who look at that mental illness as social adaptation is, and this is just my own experience, okay? You know, you talk about, because I'm a phenomenologist, and when I'm working with people who are suffering from bipolar or schizophrenia or these things, that's not a sociological thing. Those individuals are suffering personally, individually from that, and it's not because of what other people are saying. In fact, I'm with you, because I've actually worked with people that I'm sure if they were working with somebody else, they would have been diagnosed as, you know, psychotic and thrown in a treatment facility and never seen again. But I worked with them in terms of finding their way through that back to things, and I didn't do the automatic societal kind of thing, and many, a number of them anyway, have, you know, put their lives together and been successful and whatever. But there was a point at which I knew if somebody else saw them in this state, that they would automatically diagnose them and throw them in, you know, a psychiatric facility. And the other comment about what you said is that I think though those things are true and are influencing factors, I don't think that I think that what gets lost in that, and this is my baby that I'm hammering, is it's sort of like, well, okay, let's not worry that much about the archetypal, shadow archetypal evil aspect of addiction. And that will kill you, okay? And I don't know whether y'all have seen this TV advertisement, this guy drives me crazy, the alcoholism addiction cure. And you can do it, man, and it's, you know, it's no AA, and I mean, there are people selling snake oil all the time in the world. My problem with this guy is that he's offering the delusional aspect to alcoholics who want to hear that. And my problem with it is that there are people dying because he's selling them snake oil. And that really bothers me, and I wish that there was some way to stop that. Yeah, Erica?
Well, I'd like to sort of bring this back to not just alcoholism, because I think there are plenty of ways that the site that Jung says we don't have complexes have us, and I think that's part of what you're trying to say. is that the healthy aspects of us, which could be shadows, get taken over by very, very archetypally, the center of a complex is the archetype. And as you work through the archetype, you get to, as you work through a complex, you get to the archetype.
Can you all hear her?
No.
Eric,
why don't you translate?
No, why don't you just say it?
Okay. Jung says that we don't have complexes, complexes have us. And at the center of a complex, the complex is a whole array of feelings, emotions, physical symptoms, what else? images, memories, all that kind of stuff, connected to our hero, archetypes, hero, mother, father, god, devil, whatever it is. That as we work on different levels of the complex and we get towards the archetypal core, we have to face what you're talking about. And this happens in trauma. In trauma, when people have been born innocently into a very traumatic, I often call it the war zone. They're born into a chaotic, destructive atmosphere that activates this, what we're talking about, the archetypal evil aspect part of the complex, the archetype. And they have to, I've worked with many people in trauma, and eventually, I recently had somebody who eventually, after years and years and years, said, I don't know what to do anymore. I simply don't know what to do. And at that point, we could actually have a discussion about the destructive complex that kept possessing this person and kept pulling them back into very self-destructive behavior, very repetitive behavior. So I think I want to broaden the discussion a little bit to just the archetypal evil in itself, the protector perpetrator, as Don Kalshid would say, that happens in our psyche and is the and in terms of theism, Buddhism is not a theistic religion. It speaks of whatever wholeness, whatever oneness, whatever that is, not in this is this or this is this. It speaks about it is this is not this. This is it's not that. 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 To get us beyond some sort of rationalistic or conceptual image of it. So I just want to throw that into the mix here.
Thanks, Eric. I did want to say there's a. John Sanford wrote a book called Evil, the Shadow Side of Reality, and in that book he talks about corporate, institutional, organizational, natural, moral evil, and archetypal shadow, archetypal evil. So you might look at that.
Right. I'd just like to make one comment about the cocaine experiment. They took rats, they put them in a cage with nothing else, they offered them cocaine in a liquid. The rats took it. When the rats were put in where there's grass outside, they can do whatever they want, there's sunshine, there's mates there, same cocaine and water was offered, they didn't take it because they had a happy society.
Yes, and I think that is part of what the protective wall of human community that Jung was referring to.
Right, exactly. Exactly. That fellowship and community can be the higher power, but we have to see it in the context of the society we're living in, or we're just fixing people so that they can support the society instead of looking for a better one.
One of the things that Jung, I mean, the AA that struck me about the 12 steps is, if you haven't noticed it, maybe you have, that they're all written as we. There's no I did this, I did that. That essentially, that recovery is within a community, you know? So people can't just buy the big book, read it, and say, oh, I'm just going to follow the principles in the big book and just do this, because that's just not effective. The gentleman over here had his hand up.
I was just going to respond to what Clinton was saying by just bringing up that it's my memory that Carl Jung spoke about in one of his books about politics, he mentioned that the most powerful political thing that any individual can do about the world outside is to go through an individuation process. And I think that I understand that to mean that we each of us in attenuating ourselves to a healthy place, a healthy center, mm-hmm. we change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that that's a different approach than a political.
Yes.
Quick thing in regard to suicide and the important thing to be focused out there. Pretty much as animals, human beings have been kill themselves, go back to getting alive, suicide. So that's one thing. But I have sort of a two-part question, and I just want your commentary on this. One of them is in regard to what Erica was saying. When you look at people, at least that are traumatized in our society today, probably every society, you see a couple common scenarios over and over and over again. There's some people with the complex that from the beginning of time, very young child, they're abused, they're traumatized, and it continues to go on throughout their life until something happens. They're going to kill themselves or they're addicted to opiates or what have you. And then there's the other individual that's traumatized. You can almost write these stories. You see it thousands of times, and years later, they're clipping along in a heroic fashion, and there's that injury or that bad trauma and everything, the floodgates, all hell breaks loose. And again, we see the same thing, the addiction. And I'm wondering, one, if you can comment on the crossover. Most people don't get post-traumatic stress disorder that are traumatized, but people in mental health, we see that do. We think everyone does. But those are the people that have it that are traumatized their whole life, or that ego, the shadow evil archetype. I'm wondering, can you comment on the interface of why so many traumatized individuals are addicted? And secondly, what we do in mental health when we convince ourselves this is good, at least in the pharmacological world, one addiction is replaced by another. And I see this in therapists that aren't physicians. The addictive meds, the Klonopins, the Valiums, the Ativan, Xanax, and Adderalls, it's awful. It's just going from one illicit substance to another, and the opiate addiction. And it's so emotional because you can't say...
You're going too fast for me.
I just want your comments.
Yeah, go back to the first question because I was formulating my thoughts on it. You were saying what again?
I want to know what your thoughts are on the interface between people that have chronic trauma and are addicted. It's like 75% of individuals are struggling with addiction.
Two things about that. One, Don Kaltrey, before he wrote that book, did a presentation on the Lesser Condizione, and he talked about, he was positing, he was beginning to formulate his protector-persecutor thing, and he posited basically archetype, shadow archetype, evil in the trauma situation with people. And I talked to him at the time about it, and that I was seeing it in addiction, and he went on to write his book and positing that, and I went on to write mine. But he was saying he saw the same kind of tremendously self-destructive stuff. My answer or my idea about it is I think that people, I mean, we know that people who have been terribly abused and traumatized, that it literally affects the development of their brain and their organs and the whole chemistry. I mean, it's really awful, you know? My take on it is that those people are in so much emotional, psychological pain that they're continually looking for symptom relief, escape from that. And so they are just setups for, you know, addictive kinds of behavior, potentially addictive behavior to alleviate that then becomes addiction. You know? And I agree that I do see that happens in many cases, and I think sadly what happens sometimes is that the focus goes away from the core trauma, where that's coming from, and people are just focusing on, you know, you're irresponsible and you're messing up and you can't keep a job and you're and they have no real understanding.
Some people try, it seems to follow that point, that bad choices are in society or corporate, or bad people or bad men are bad. It just seems to follow them. And they're not really consciously looking for it. They're not attracted to it, but it's just recurrent and recurrent. And those are the people you see addicted. And it just makes me think about this evil archetype. You know, sometimes it's like, wow, this is really bad karma. But I mean, people that are traumatized, it happens over and over in your adult life. But I've never understood why. But you can almost, when you've seen it hundreds and hundreds, you can almost predict the next thing in their narrative.
Yeah, I think they got dealt a really bad hand, and they have to play it, and that's really tough. Yes?
I just wondered if you could comment a little bit on what happened to the orbit of people around someone who's dealing with that level of archetypal evil, that, you know, if people that are immediately around someone who's struggling with that, and can they also get pulled into their own addictive pattern in the archetypal?
Well,
I guess I'm wondering about the co-addictive relationship, I guess, is sort of what I'm talking about.
Well, one of the studies that was done a while back found that around, well, this is with alcoholics, but you could probably put it in terms of addicted folks, that for every one person, there are 15 other people who are immediately affected by that. You know, family, friends, husbands, wives, children. I mean, you start thinking about it. So, and many of the codependent Al-Anon people who should be in Al-Anon, they get just as consumed, and it's almost like the stopping the person who's doing the drugs or alcohol becomes an addictive obsession to them that just destroys their life, you know? That's why Al-Anon is always focused on nothing to do with the alcoholic or the addicted person. It's about, what are you doing to take care of yourself to make your life work? You know, let's focus on that. You know, that's what you need to be working on. Get off of that, you know, that focus. So, yes?
I was grateful that you talked about the need for individuals to establish a relationship with their personal shadow, because the personal shadow is in so many ways the best defense about being overwhelmed by the archetypal shadow. If your personal shadow remains unconscious to you, it can then become identified with the archetypal shadow. And I want to give an illustration from my experience.
Sure. Would you mind doing that on the microphone so people can hear you?
Okay.
Who brought those toys, huh?
Did you hear what I said at the beginning? I've got a preacher's voice, so I figured you could hear me. There are many illustrations that can support what Dave's been saying, but at the age of 18, I was in the U.S. Armored Infantry in the 3rd Division in Europe, 3rd Armored Division, and we captured the town of Nordhausen. And there was a very large concentration camp on the edge of Nordhausen. And that was where they made the V-2 rockets. The factory was built into a mountain, so you couldn't bomb the factory. You could only bomb the labor camp. And the thing that, I mean, there were two things that were very powerful. One was when we went into the camp, these frail skeleton-like bodies were piled up, the corpses, and the living bodies looked at you with eyes straight out of hell, and the guards had all fled, the German troops had all fled. And as so many others have described, I, especially as an 18-year-old, I was looking on the face of hell itself, on a radical form of archetypal evil. And one of the things we did was we forced the good burghers of the town of Nordhausen to come out of their homes and line up, and we marched them through this camp, and they looked upon this. Now, this was within smelling distance of their everyday lives. And what you saw was avoidance, inability to in any way acknowledge consciously that they had in some way participated in this. And there's so many other examples. And Jung says that the greatest contribution we can make to human society and human culture is to establish a conscious relationship to our own personal shadows. Part of what this meant for me was it was a lot easier to have to shoot and kill Germans. And you talk about shadow. Killing another human being is as dark a shadow as an individual can have personally. But I wrote home to my parents that night after I'd been through this. I wrote and I said, I described what I'd obscene, and I said, now I know I have to be here, and I know why I have to do what I have to do. So, having a relationship to the personal shadow, what the German nation was caught by was an ideological addiction that in every way was promoted and supported. And it's an example of the larger cultural issue and the individual shadow issue.
Thank you, Dad. Yes. Yes?
I just had a very quick question. You had mentioned that alcoholism was psychological, but is it also physical?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I had to shorten things up a lot, yeah. And so even basically, what I was trying to emphasize in my book was the psychological aspects of addiction, and I think what's been happening way too much in society has been that it's sort of about the brain and the biochemical and, you know, and all these other aspects that they are involved. But what's gotten short shrift has been the psychological aspect. A couple of examples to try to illustrate the significance of the psychological aspect that I do talk about are, for example, if it's just a physiological exposure to the addictive substance, okay, that should trigger an addiction. But I know people, and I'm not advising this, suggesting this, but I know people who are addicted to alcohol, but they go receive the Eucharist in bread and wine form at Mass, and it does not trigger the addiction for them, okay? Now, that's psychological. I'm sorry. So what is it? You know, there's something different in taking of that alcohol. I've worked with eating disorder people, and they taught me this, that because I said, well, you know, well, how can you distinguish between when it, you know, eating's good for you or bad for you? You know, I mean, you have to eat to live, so it's not like you can just totally abstain. And they told me, so, oh, no, we know absolutely. When we're eating for legitimate nutritional reasons, we know that. When we're eating to fill the emptiness and out of emotional stuff, that's really a totally different thing, and that's when they usually would be in. Again, there's a psychological aspect. I've worked with people who have been in really bad accidents or had a lot of painful things medically. And it's very, very dangerous for them to be on pain medications and stuff to activate their addiction, etc. But what they found was, and I saw this, if they did exactly what the doctor prescribed, no more often, no high dosage, they did exactly what was meant for therapeutic purposes, it didn't activate the addiction. If they started taking more than they were supposed to, or they started taking it more frequently, that activated the psychological addiction. Okay. Now, one last example that people who I know, because of injuries or whatever, wound up getting physiologically addicted to pain medication. They were weaned off and withdrawn from that. But they never did have to go out and hold up people in the street and break into pharmacies. They literally did not have a psychological addiction. They had a physiological addiction. And once that was gone, now, a lot of people have both physiological and psychological, but I'm making the point that there really is a phenomenon called, you know, that is psychological addiction. And I believe that there's, you know, the hereditary and nutritional and brain chemistry things and all those other things, and I think they are really important. But my thing is to say, look, but let's also not just do away with the psychological part, because it is very, very important. Yes?
I guess kind of along this line, I'm curious that psychological addiction is always the same psychological addiction, or whether there would be differences for kind of where people are in their life path, or, you know, if it's a 16-year-old kid who gets addicted, kind of psychologically addicted to alcohol, would have a totally different set of resources to deal with it than the person you mentioned who, you know, 50 years old has a, you know, loses a job and goes through a crisis.
Well, I mean, what I would say to that is everybody, I mean, I'm talking in general about things, but everybody has their individual story and reasons and what went into that, what it's compensating for in their lives. In fact, many people, I usually tell people who come to me, and it's clear that they need to get sober or straight. And what I usually say to them is, look, you know, you go do that, and you come back in 6 months, and let's see when you're sober and straight and what's cleaned up, okay? And then I'll work with you on, because they want to come in and work on, why am I this way? We can't even get to that because we haven't taken the first 3 steps. And I know that, they don't know that. But once they've stopped, the addiction increases its power in a person by getting the person to participate in more of the addicted activity. If you can stop a person from participating in their addictive activity for whatever reason, okay? They're in jail and they can't get their stuff, you know? The drugs dry up on the street. It doesn't make it any difference. But sometimes what it does is it just allows enough breathing space that some other things can happen, you know? So there are lots of individual, every story is individual, and a lot of the work that I do with people after they're in recovery is to piece together what happened and why they were doing that, and what that was all about, what it was compensating for, etc. My theory is that addiction ultimately starts out with a person wanting the addictive activity is an attempt to cope with living.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a successful thing, but that's what it's about. You know, that's what it is. Back here.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about adolescent psychology and addiction. And if this kind of ego surrender is something that is developmentally appropriate.
We can't hear.
If ego surrender is developmentally appropriate for adolescents,
Well, first of all, I think it's really important with adolescents to realize that there's a lot of experimenting and developmental stuff that's involved with alcohol and drugs. It's got nothing to do with being addicted, okay? And I've had people, when I was working in the treatment program, come in, some young people, and, you know, they had a death of a friend, and they started drinking like crazy, and, you know, the parents threw them in the facility, and I said, look, this is a grief reaction. This guy is not addicted. You know, he needs help in terms of his grief process. So we have to distinguish those kinds of things. But, and I have worked with adolescents who are truly addicted, and they still have to go through this process. In other words, it's a collapse of the false ego. I mean, in other words, they have to build up. I mean, part of what happens, and I didn't say this, and I guess I should have, but when that ego collapses, you still have to function in the world. So what do? Well, you can't trust your judgment and your assessment of things and you know, the way you put things together. So what do you trust? Well, you trust the wisdom of the sponsors and the program and the people who have gone through this, and you have to turn it over in terms of like saying, well, I really don't know, and I'll lean on this person because maybe they know, you know. But you cannot. I mean, the one thing we trust is what? It's our judgment, our assessment of things, the way we see the world. And so you're telling an addicted person the one thing you can't trust is what they inherently trust until they get far enough in recovery that the normal ego, and it does come back, regenerates. There was a study, Harvard Mental Health Bulletin, I read this a number of years ago, and it was really interesting. Again, the psychological aspect of addiction. They did a MMPI and some other tests on people who were drinking, people who were early in sobriety, and then all the way down the road. You know, what they found was that for the first 2 years after a person stopped drinking, they were psychologically as screwed up as the people who were drinking. Okay, for 2 years after. All right. Now, this is one of the things that AA figured out a long time ago, and they tell people, do not make any major life changes or decisions for the first year you're sober, because you don't really know anything. So they're still recovering. The good news was that after 15 years or more, you couldn't tell the ego situation, the psychological health situation of the addicted people from normal people, you know, out there. So it does recover and regenerate, but it really takes time. Yes?
Yes, I'm struck by, when I was listening to your presentation and people's comments, it reminded me of a line from Eugene O'Neill's play, The Great God Brown, and I wrote it down as I'm listening. Man, or I could use it, man or women, are born broken, he or she heals by mending. Grace is the mending. And it kind of reminds me of this, of turning over to higher powers, grace. And Eugene O'Neill's mother was addicted to opiates. And when he was born, I think she was already, or shortly after, she lost a baby, and the doctor said, you got to take opiates, and she got hooked on it. And that play, what was it, One Day's Journey Into Night? And the play of a family of suffering from the mother was upstairs shooting up. And Eugene O'Neill's, it was his family. He and his brother and his father were downstairs getting drunk, you know. And I was just thinking how this the trauma goes through the generations. Eugene O'Neill's brother committed suicide. Eugene O'Neill's two of his sons committed suicide. You know, that he didn't have a self, his mother didn't mirror him. His mother he had a hole in his soul. He wasn't mirrored effectively. And then, but through his art, he saved himself. But I wonder, the ravages it goes through the whole family.
Yeah,
you mentioned
I'm a big Walker person. and Walker's grandfather and father committed suicide. I mean, I think there was a really depressive hereditary thing. And then there's a question about his mother who died in a car accident drowning, that she didn't make any attempt to get out of the car but released her other son to survive. And Walker, I think, he saved himself through his writing and art, through his wrestling with the existential questions in his books, in his work. Yes.
The idea of it being spiritual and not, we're talking psychological, and this idea that spirit, the kind of spiritual, the Jung even opened up with that idea that the alcoholic is yearning for wholeness, that really just mimics a sense of wholeness, or any addictive pocket of something. So I'm just curious, listening to the way this is going, and there's a chapter in a big book that's called We Agnostics. Mm-hmm. It's not you agnostics, it's not the agnostic, it's called We Agnostics. And it's kind of interesting, and I pondered it a lot, given the fact that it seems like the definition of an agnostic is someone who needs proof in those who are addictive and potentially going to die or live a pretty miserable life of addiction. In AA, it seems like a pretty brilliant opportunity to find proof. Today offers an opportunity for a person to experience something personally that isn't taught about something that's either Christian or Buddhist, or that there's an open-mindedness to AA about a spiritual path that answers that question, which the drink at one time answered. That I found an essence of life in a drink.
Yes.
And when I was
I want to respond to that, and I want to read this to close. But yes, that the thought ran away.
Can I say one thing about that? Yes. Just real quick, because you talked about fluidity, and what I think in your map that's so interesting is that one first moment when you admit you don't know. Like, what does it take to make that the point of change? And it seems like there's some the ego, if it has this capacity to identify, because it's an identifying capacity, and to attach to something, it actually also has the capacity to let go. And that is where it can become fluid. And it may be that the alcoholic that's looking for fluidity is actually looking for an ego that can attach and let go. And to do both, so that that the let go place is a place of trust that you can't do that alone. That even though it seems like on sequential steps, you're saying there's a higher power, there's a community around me. I think there's a trust in that higher power community in that first act to do that.
Yes, I agree. What I wanted to read in closing was that because this just blew me away when I read it. It's from Robert Thompson's book on Bill W., his biographer. And this was Bill W.'s experience of his first drink, okay? Perhaps it took a little time, but it seemed to happen instantly. He could feel his body relaxing, a stiffness going out of his shoulders, as he sensed the warm glow seeping through him into all the distant, forgotten corners of his being. Soon he had the feeling that he wasn't the one being introduced, but that people were being introduced to him. He wasn't joining groups. Groups were forming around him. It was unbelievable. And at the sudden realization of how quickly the world could change, he had to laugh, and he couldn't stop laughing. It was a miracle. There was no other word. A miracle that was affecting him mentally, physically, and as he would soon learn, spiritually too. Still smiling, he looked at people around him. They were not superior beings, they were friends. They liked him and he liked them. When he left, at his back, he could hear the whine of a saxophone, little waves of voices rising and falling, but now they in no way ran against the overwhelming joy he was feeling. His world was all around him, young and fresh and loving. And as he made his way down the drive, he moved easily, gracefully, as though he knew exactly how he felt. All his life he had been living in chains. Now he was free. That was Bill W.'s first drink.
Wow.
I mean, how seductive, how powerful can something be? And that does tell you something about the, you know, the mistaken thing that is looked for in drink or in addiction, you know, by virtue of it. Well, listen, I really appreciate everybody coming out on a Friday night, and I thank you very much for showing up and being here. Thank you very much.